We invite you to stay tuned as Meet a Pioneer is next.
A good sound is hard to find. You always get the other kind. Yes, your dial is set to the greatest sound yet. 660 on your radio is KFAR in Fairbanks. 'Cause a good sound nowadays is hard to find.
Good morning, friends. Welcome to KFAR Radio's Meet a Pioneer. Today is September 27th, 1985. I'm Gail Malloy. Each Friday morning at 9 o'clock, we meet a pioneer. We'll spend the next hour with Mr. Bud Myers. He is best known for his career in real estate. This morning's presentation is sponsored by Two Rivers Lodge, the Riverboat Discovery, Denali Chiropractic Clinic, the Forget-Me-Not Gift Shop, Mount McKinley Mutual Savings Bank, Last Frontier Realty, and Dorothy Rice's Rosenthistle. And now, Paul Rosenthal's Variation on the Alaska Flag Song. Good morning, Bud Myers, and welcome to the studios of KFAR Radio.
Good morning, Gail. Nice. And people.
Well, you always like to mention what the weather conditions are so that sometime if we ever listen to the tape again, we can kind of get the feeling for what's going on outside. It's kind of a cloudy, overcast day. It's about 50 degrees, and it's September, kind of getting close to October. I mentioned earlier you have a well-known career in real estate, but you've certainly done a lot of things, so we're going to find out all about that. And right now, your people at Bud Myers Real Estate are listening to the radio, I think. Isn't that right?
Yes, correct.
So for 1 hour, they're not going to be taking care of business.
Ooh, I hope not altogether.
Well, you were recently out of town last week, and you've just returned.
Yes, I just got back day before yesterday in the morning. My mother passed on, and so I went out for that.
Oh, how old was your mother?
Oh, she was had to be 62, I guess. No, she was 88.
Uh-huh, she was.
Yeah.
Your mother was really a hard worker when you were a kid. You had an interesting start in life. Where were you born?
August 23rd, 1914.
August 23rd. Where in the country was that?
That I was born in Minnesota, a little town called Wilmont.
Uh-huh. What'd your folks do?
My father was he was born as a carpenter, contractor, and followed that type of work.
And followed all over the country, I understand.
Yes, he did. He was a great traveler. He moved from job to job, and there was always a better job somewhere else. So my childhood was spent moving around considerably from place to place.
You don't like light bulbs in the middle of a room ceiling. Tell me why.
I don't know if that's the reason, but I don't like a light bulb hanging in the center of a room or even a modern fixture in the middle of a bedroom. I like wall lighting and that type of thing. I think it was because we traveled so much and we would stay in hotels when my dad was going from job to job, and they would always have that one light globe hanging down by a cord in the center of the room, and I think I grew to dislike that.
Huh.
The rooms those days, it was quite a thing if they had running water within the room, and warm water even more so, and very, very few hotels that we went to in those days had a bathroom. We had the old chambermaid who brought in the wash basin with the pitcher and the chamber pot that went under the bed, and that's the way they lived in those days.
Gosh. Now, in the family was your folks and then you and a sister.
Yes.
Was she older or younger?
My sister's a year and a half older than I am.
Uh-huh. Is she in the area?
No, she lives in Tacoma. She retired recently. She worked for Bell Telephone for a little over 40 years.
Gee whiz. Now,
steady.
Before you came up to Alaska, you kind of did work your way across the country from Tacoma, and it was there, I understand, that you as a kid took an interest in boxing.
Yes, I did. I started boxing just as a kid. My dad liked that sort of thing, and he was a kind of a wrestler, so he bought boxing gloves when I was 3 or 4 years old, and from that time on, I was always boxing in school and that type of thing.
In for sports?
Yes.
And wrestling, too?
Wrestling, too,
huh.
Yes.
Were there any idols in boxing or wrestling that you looked at and wanted to be like?
Well,
who are the big names of the days?
Well, of course, I don't think many people remember, but my idol of wrestling, of course, was Strangler Lewis, who was a world champion. And my fighter, I think, was Gene Tooney, because for some reason or other, we wanted somebody to beat Jack Dempsey, and so I followed Tooney, and the first fight I remember him fighting, we listened on a radio for the neighbors next door, and I bet 10 cents on Tooney, and I won, but they didn't pay me. But
you never collected the dime.
Yeah.
Did you, there was the Northwest Gym, is that what it was called, in Tacoma?
Well, that was in Tacoma, yeah. Uh-huh. The Northwest Gym produced a lot of top fighters. Freddie Steele, the world middleweight champion, and Fred Lenhart, the world's light heavyweight champion. We're all products out of Northwest Gym.
Did you, you stole newspapers there as a boy and watched them or something?
Yes, I did. Sure. I was boxing in school and then in the YMCA and the Elks Club, but that was strictly pro, but of course I spent a lot of time there, and I also had a newspaper corner right down from Northwest Gym, so that made it handy, and I got to know quite a few of the fellows then too. And Freddie Steele refereed one fight I had. I always remembered that.
Huh. We're going to find more about it. This is Bud Myers, my guest on Meet a Pioneer. We'll take our first break and be back in just a moment. Meet a Pioneer is sponsored in part by the Forget-Me-Not Gift Shop. Sam and Jane McConkie believe beautiful things are timeless, and everything you find at the Forget-Me-Not shop is beautiful. Fine linen, silver, crystal, decorator items for your home or office, and that little something for special friends. Forget-Me-Not adds a feeling of luxury to even the most practical items. So, for beautiful things for years to come, for your friends, your home, or for yourself, remember the Forget-Me-Not Gift Shop, open 10 to 6, 6 days a week in Northgate Square.
20 years ago, Mount McKinley Bank was founded by a group of forward-looking individuals who saw a need in the community. The new bank offered low-interest loans to encourage new home building in the Fairbanks area. It was an immediate success. Today, Mount McKinley Mutual Savings Bank is still located at 530 4th Avenue in the same building where founder Julian Rice and first president Judge Vernon Forbes served on the first board of trustees. The bank has seen a lot of history, and their solid background of investment and involvement in the community has earned Mount McKinley their own place in Fairbanks history. Mount McKinley Mutual Savings Bank is proud to sponsor Meet a Pioneer. At Mount McKinley, they're looking forward to a future as proud as their past.
Alaska's spirit will never die. It lives on in second-generation Alaskans like Dr. Carol Davis of Denali Chiropractic Clinic.
Sponsoring Meet a Pioneer gives Carol an opportunity to show her pride in being an Alaskan and pride in being a member of the world's largest drugless healing profession. Becoming a chiropractor meant years of demanding study, a period of internship, and then meeting tough licensing standards. She's happy to talk about chiropractic with anyone interested in learning more. Just call 456-5252 or stop by and see Dr. Carol Davis at 1018 College Road on the east edge of Kramer's Field. Now back to our program, Meet a Pioneer.
Welcome back. My guest is Bud Myers on Meet a Pioneer at 16 past 9 o'clock. Now, you graduated then, it sounds like, during the 1930s. What was life like? What did your future look like at the time after graduation in the 30s?
Oh, yeah, it was the heart of the Depression, of course, and I graduated from high school, I think it was in 1933, and there was hardly a smokestack going on the entire tide flats of Tacoma, so-called the lumber capital of the world, but it was dead. And it was kind of tough then, so I looked for work and worked at several different jobs at that time. I worked for the Washington State Game Department for about a year, worked in seven or eight different logging camps, and cannery and name it, and I did it. I remember I was working in a cannery when Roosevelt developed the NRA and they raised our wages. That was called the National Recovery Act, and they raised our wages to 26 cents an hour, which was quite a thing at that time. After these jobs, I went back into the woods and was working there when the bug to come to Alaska had been bothering me for years, either Tahiti or Alaska.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So I was working in the woods. It was right around the 1st of March, and it was a beautiful day down there. I was working in a place out of Enumclaw, Washington. So I couldn't stand it anymore, and I said, I'm going to Alaska. So I couldn't get a speeder or train down to the camp, so I walked. And I knew an older fellow there that was a kind of a neighbor, so I stopped and where he was working, and I asked him if he would loan me $50. I didn't have enough to go to Alaska. And he asked me first if I was crazy, and then said, he looked at me and seen I was serious, and he said yes. So I continued down, and it wasn't a week later, I caught a boat at Seattle to head for my future in Alaska, which I intended to be maybe one season as a trial.
And you left behind your mother and sister. Your father had passed away
yes,
by then. Uh-huh.
Yes, my father had died.
Uh-huh.
So I took the steamer Yukon, as I remember it, at Seattle, steerage, and if I remember right, the fare was around 30-some dollars, and I had that ticket. I also had a train ticket, and of course, in those days, it took about 5 days to get to Seward, the headquarters of the train, to Fairbanks, and then we stopped at Anchorage, and then stayed overnight at Curry on the train and came into Fairbanks. So it was just about 7 days to get to Fairbanks from Seattle.
Well, how did you have any money in your pocket when you got here? Do you have any money left when you got here?
I had less than $2. I remember that. I had a dollar something. And I went in a restaurant, which was later going to employ me. I went in because I kind of knew one fellow up here, and he had written me a letter that he was working as a dishwasher in the Pioneer Grill. So I went in there, and I remember I had a bowl of stew with 50 cents. And then I arranged to stay all night at a friend of his room. He had a room above the First National Bank, where it is now, above a barber shop. I think it was called the Comet Barber Shop. So when I had come across the bridge, when I got off the train, it was getting cold, and it was the very first part of March, and that night it got about 21 below zero, and I thought, my God. But I felt pretty good laying on my sleeping bag in that warm room, so it didn't go bad the first night I was there.
Did you wonder if maybe you should have gone to Tahiti?
Yes. I had met a couple of fellows on the boat coming up, and we played pinochle, and they were good friends, and they were from Port Angeles, and they were just going to Anchorage, and I asked them what they were going to do, and they said they were going to trap or something if they could out of Anchorage. So we met in the Lane Hotel, and they asked me to join them in their venture. And I said, well, I got my ticket to Fairbanks, so I'll go on up there, and I'll try to get back down if it don't work out. And I never did go back to Anchorage. That was it here.
Well, tell me about Mike and the first cabin you stayed in.
Oh, yeah. It was difficult to find a place to stay, really, especially with no money. And I had met a couple also on the boat that I called the Polish boys. They were actually immigrants as children, and of course you couldn't tell they were Polish unless you knew it. But I met them after my night in the room. I met them walking on the street, and they said they were looking for a place to stay. So I said, well, I don't have any money, but I got to find a place, too. So, well, I said, we'll look together. So we talked to a couple other fellas we'd met on the boat, and they told us about an old man about 80 years old who had a cabin on 8th Avenue between Cushman and Barnett. And they said that maybe we could rent that. So they told us where he lived, and we went up there, and he said, yes, he had that cabin on 8th, and he wanted $20 a month for it. And so we told him we didn't have any money, and he said, well, I'll tell you what I'll do. He said, my last tenant just shot himself in the cabin. He said he put a Luger under his chin and pulled the trigger, and he said he kind of blew the upper part of his head all over the ceiling. No, he says, And he said, I'm having trouble to get somebody to clean that up. If you'll go in and clean it up, you boys, I'll give you 2 weeks' rent for it. So, gosh, we jumped at the opportunity. So we went in and cleaned it up and settled down in that cabin. And the 2 weeks went by fast. We hunted some rabbits, and we bought a hindquarter of caribou, and we were pretty hungry, but we existed. And then 2 weeks to the day, Mike headed down for his rent, and he walked with a cane, and evidently one of his legs pained him, because every time he would take one particular step, he would grunt. So we noticed that when he first come down, and we kind of stalled him when he come down. We said none of us had had anything to do yet, and we wondered if he could wait just another week. He said, yes, that's all. But things didn't work out quite that week. So he came down again, and we thought, geez, what are we going to do? But we could hear him coming because he'd go, like that. So we closed the door, and we all laid in the cabin real quiet. And Mike hammered on the door. I want my rent, he says. I know you're in there. So we didn't stir. And he finally went away. And the next day he was back again, and we heard him coming. And again we laid in there, and he said, I'm coming with my gun next time, he says. So I had been contacting this Pioneer Grill, and their dishwasher was leaving. So I got a job there washing dishes until the old dishwasher came back. So I went to work there, and about I was given one meal and $25 a week. So I worked one day, and the end of the second day, I went to the NC company, and the old gentleman, which the old timers will all know, was old George Preston, was the manager of the NC company. So I was going to try to arrange some credit with him to buy some groceries. They had a grocery department then. And so they set this appointment up, and I sat down with Mr. Preston and talked to him, and he asked me what I was doing and where I was staying and what my intentions were and that. And so he sat for a minute and looked at me a long time, and I thought, boy, I blowed this one. But he said, I'll tell you what I'm going to do, young man. He said, I'm going to give you $25 credit in our grocery department. So I thanked him very much and went to the grocery department then and bought bread and bacon and butter and canned stuff. And I went home, and two Polish boys and I, we had a real celebration.
Oh, I bet. Golly. Huh. And I guess he got paid back.
I paid them.
Did you keep up your boxing here?
Well, I got, when I got to town, I run into some fella and was talking to him on the street. And we got talking about where we come from and what we'd done. And I said, well, I'd kind of followed boxing and wrestling, and I'd won a scholastic championship in wrestling in Washington State. So he said, geez, I know where you might pick up a buck. I said, well, where is that? And he said, well, there is an ex-light heavyweight championship of the world here, a wrestler, and his name is Alaska Pete, and he has a room down at the Pioneer Hotel. And so I went down there and talked to him, and he was one tough-looking customer, and he invited me up to his room. He says, I got to see what you can do. So I went up to his room, and in amateur wrestling, we'd just played around looking like pros, and that was the limit of my experience. But so he took his shirt off, and he was a big bruiser, and all right, now, he says, go to it. And I stepped up to him, and he some way batted his right hand on one side of my head and the other so fast I couldn't see, and my ears were ringing and everything else. And then we went through a few holes and everything, and he said he had a fellow called Killer Lyons who was going to wrestle, and they held the matches then in the old Eagles Hall. So I arranged this match, and we got ready to go, and he said, of course, you have to lose this first match. Oh, I have to lose. Why? And he said, because then we'll have a big return match and make some money. I said, mm-hmm. Well, okay. I said, how are you going to do that? He said, we will have the best two falls out of three, he said, and my boy will take the first one, and then we'll wrestle straight on the second one to see if you go to the third round. I said, all right. And so I lost the first one, and then I beat Killer Lyons the second, and then I lost the third. But
the people really thought it was a heck of a match. We put on a pretty good show, and they come running in. But mainly I was pleased because at that time the best job you could get out of Fairbanks really was the FE company, and I wanted to go to work there pretty bad. And Jack Boswell then was the superintendent at Ester Creek, and Bill Shoddy was a foreman, and they were at the wrestling match, and so I got acquainted with them, and eventually got a job through Jack Boswell, and then worked there for 5 years after I got the job.
Huh, at the FE company then?
Yes.
Now, in 1940, were you the champion in the territory?
Well,
a boxing champ, or what was the title?
They had a lot of boxing going on, and my first year there, I had two matches, and as I say, I had been kind of keeping up as an amateur, and I was manager of the high school boxing team, and this type of thing. But I had two matches in 1936. I lost them both. One to a young man by the name of Bob Rutledge, who was being trained by a pro here to fight out of here quite a bit, and he was good. And then I had another match with a fellow that turned out to be a friend of mine by the name of Gus Crutch. Of course, Gus was about 6 feet and outweighed me 30 pounds, and he was a little too much for me. But I could see they liked boxing and wrestling here because there was no TV or things to like that to entertain people. So they entertained themselves and with card parties, dances, get-togethers, athletic events, and this type of thing. So anyway, I went out the first year in 1936. I went home, and during my days of my downtown paper route, which included pool rooms and gambling joints and this type of thing, I got acquainted with a lot of people there and out of the Northwest Gym, which was right down there. And I had become acquainted during that time with a fighter who won the welterweight Pacific Coast Pro Championship by the name of Morgan Jones. His brother Harold Jones had been among the top five middleweights. So I looked Morgan up, and I said, I think I might be able to make a few dollars up there if I could get a little more polished. So anyway, I worked out with Morgan then that whole winter, and it did help me. And so I started boxing here, and I had worked with a gentleman who is still here, Ernie Stolen, who was the big promoter in those days. He promoted most of the fights. So I started my little side career of boxing. And I had a kind of initial success. In fact, they started to call me One Round Myers. I had a few one-round knockouts. And then I got knocked out in the first round myself. So they really called me One Round Myers at that time. Anyway, that led, though, to my so-called championship of the territory in 1940. I fought he had been more of a college champion than he had a pro. And he worked where I did, and I watched him work out, and I felt that I should beat him. And I almost did in the first round, but he came out of a crouch, and that was the last thing I remembered. However, when I got up, he did ask me who won the fight. So we had both taken some pretty good punches.
Huh.
Then he later fought. I fought a semifinal then, and he fought the champion on the coast and from Anchorage. And he fought under the name Young Tommy Cornwall. And he defeated Johnny Orr, the fellow that had Mm-hmm. And I won in a knockout in my first, in my semifinal at that show.
We're going to take a break and be right back.
Meet a Pioneer. KFAR Radio is proud of this show, and we're proud of our sponsors. Take it from Agbaba, folks. One of the greatest pleasure trips you'll ever take is a trip up the Chena and Tanana Rivers aboard the Riverboat Discovery. It's scenic, it's fun, it's a little adventure back into Alaska's past, a real riverboating adventure, guided and informed by lifetime Pioneer Alaskans, the Binkley family. The Binkleys, three generations of riverboat captains on Alaskan waters, whose knowledge and love of Alaska is unsurpassed. Try the Riverboat Discovery, and when your trip is complete, you'll feel like we do here at KFAR. It's a joy to speak of the Riverboat Discovery, and it's a pleasure to do business with the Binkleys.
When Roy Larson started Larson's Jewelers on that day back in 1946, he had big dreams of what he'd like his business to become. Over the years, some of those dreams changed and others came true. Today, Larson's is still a family-owned business and one of the finest and most complete jewelry stores in the interior. Almost 40 years of skill and experience go into everything they do. Like Fairbanks, they've grown, but they're still your friend and neighbor. Larson's, fine jeweler since 1946 at 405 Noble.
Sponsors of Meet a Pioneer enjoy the history and people of Fairbanks, like Dorothy Rice of the Rose and Thistle, a member of the community since 1956. The Rose and Thistle is many things, a florist shop with two experienced designers who do lovely fresh and silk arrangements, a wedding and formal shop with over 100 gowns in the shop, plus personal service and consultation. You'll find the Rose and Thistle at 330 Wendell Street, Monday through Saturday. Stay tuned for more Meet a Pioneer with Gail Malloy.
We're back with my guest, Bud Myers. Boy, that boxing was quite a part of your life then.
Yeah. Anyway, to end the boxing, I ended up with the trepidation of fighting this young Tommy after he had stopped the boy that had stopped me, and it took all my courage, and I did, and I ended up winning, and that was in 1940.
Uh-huh. Now, you worked for the F.E. Company up till the war started. Quickly, what did you do for the F.E. Company?
Well, I started out in those days. When I first started, we worked 12-hour days, and I would, first it was on the bull gang, just hard work, and then I got into what people kind of liked as a job. They're running what we call a giant or a gun, which is a hydraulic machine, and we would remove muck, and everything went down the drain, and we'd fall those big cliffs of frost, sometimes 100 feet high, come down. It was kind of an interesting job, so I stayed at that then.
Huh. And you worked underground too?
Yes, I did. One winter I worked underground up in a place called Coogee Gulch, which is on the way to Circle Hot Springs.
Now, when the war started, how did that change your life? Did you get drafted, or what happened? What was your involvement?
Well, that would go into how I happened to take over what was called Rickert Gardens then, or the Rickert Subdivision. In my boxing, I had met a man here who sold vegetables out of a wagon for Mr. and Mrs. Rickert. And he got to be a good friend of Paul and Stacia Rickert. And they made a agreement with him in writing, a contract wherein he would buy the entire Rickert subdivision, Rickert estate, Rickert homestead. And
where was the Rickert homestead?
Well, that consisted of a piece of ground that run from about 12th between between Cushman and Barnett and up to 18th.
Uh-huh.
And there was some on both sides of Cushman Street. It was quite a piece of ground. But in those days, it was gardens and rabbits, and they did have five large greenhouses there and raised vegetables year-round. They were kind of the major supplier of vegetables at that time for Fairbanks. Anyway, this fellow started to, he had a little problem with booze and which progressed, and his wife left him, and of course I knew them both very well, and so he said to me, he says, I've got to go, would you take over this thing for me? And I said, well, I don't know. He says, do you have any money? And I said, well, Jack, I have about $600. That's plenty, he said. It's your deal. So at his suggestion, I went to Julian Hurley and had an assignment of a contract drawn up. In the meantime, though, he went on a good one, and he was in old St. Joe's Hospital with the DTs. So we waited one day, and they said he was better, so we went up, and that's where I signed the deal to buy a Rickert subdivision. And at that time, it had these five greenhouses and a boarding house and a flower business, so I took that whole thing over, and that first winter was an experience. I had about five coal fires I had to keep going, run the boarding house. I made corsages and shipped flowers in, and I had it coming from every direction. In the meantime, I decided...
And you ran the greenhouses, too? Or kept the greenhouses going?
No, I didn't. Oh. I shut those down that winter. I took whatever was out of them, and I shut those down.
Uh-huh.
And... then I decided that I'd kind of stick with that. I kind of liked it, so I thought I would build a store. And
a grocery store?
A grocery with produce as a major.
Uh-huh.
And so I built a building right on the corner, right where the First National Bank branch sits, on which would be, 13th and Cushman. That's where I had my store, and the front would open up so it faced directly to Gaffney Road where they come from the base, and I would get all this exposure.
Uh-huh.
So I had a good idea, and I rustled around and got an old gentleman that had a store to kind of grubstake me for some canned stuff, and I got scales, and I had produce, and I was all ready to open, and my number was drawn out of the glass bowl in Washington, D.C. in the first draft. And so I didn't know what to do. They formed a committee here, draft board, and I was called. So I went to my friend, old Ed Stroker, at the bank and told him my problem, and he said, well, until you get on your feet, you better try to get in defense work. And I said, well, what am I going to do with that store? I'm about ready to open in a couple of days. He said, get rid of it. So I went to Piggly Wiggly and talked to the then owner, was Earl Hausman, and he agreed to buy everything I had in the store. So I sold it lock, stock, and barrel, and then even sold the building and moved the building away. And then I went to work first at Ladd Field.
Well, being so close to opening that after having built it and stocked it yourself, wasn't that a great disappointment?
Yes, but not as much of a one as that glass bowl deal, though, being pulled out. That was more of a disappointment.
Yeah.
So then I started a career of defense work. I worked on quite a few jobs in different places. I worked at Ladd, then at Big Delta, Jarvis Creek. And then I went to Ileana Lake for 7 months there, and then back to Dry Creek, then to Ruby, and then Galena.
Huh. Now, was it during that time that you rafted those buildings down the river?
Yes. They had what they called a CAA station, at Ruby, which consisted of four or five houses and a control tower. And then they had the big tower there, which was colorful. They pulled that tower over to dismantle it with one of the old river boats, one of the old stern wheelers. They pulled it over and dismantled it that way. And then we went in and got all the houses ready to move in the control tower, which had quite a lot of expensive equipment in it. So it was a kind of a, when I look back on it, it was a very nervy project by the government, and an old contractor here by the name of Batchelder had the contract working for Green Construction. So they got these houses all ready, and then we would, I took several crews with a boat, and we'd go up and cut big long logs and bring them down, and then move one log on at Ruby right there. They had a nice beach to work off, and then we would move one log in, and then another one, and then we would tie wire between the two logs, and then slip empty oil drums under it, then move it on out, and so on until we had a big raft sticking out in the Yukon, and then we put planks on it, and with cats we brought the houses down, chimneys in them and everything, and we moved them down onto these rafts and then take them down the Yukon to Galena, where they were installing the station there.
You can just imagine what that must have looked like.
Oh, yeah, that was really an interesting job.
Wow. Huh. Now, at what point, I know you had a pool hall in a place for a while. When did you do that? What was that all about?
Well, I was working at Galena till around the 1st of December in 41, and it got very cold down there, and right on that Yukon, believe me, it got cold. It even have a breeze sometimes. And to move out of a bunkhouse that was just man wall to wall, I'm going to be brave, and I pitched a tent down on the river, and I said, I'm going to make my sleeping quarters down here. And I moved the stove in. But it got down to 50-some below, and I was trying to stalk that tent, and I froze the end of my nose in bed even, and when the fire went out. So they closed the job down, and I wrote my draft board and sent a note in and asked them if I could go out and visit my mother and everything. I hadn't been out for several years, and then I was coming back, and they were going to reopen the job. But instead of that, I got my draft notice, and the next plane that came back, so I went in to go into the service. Then I had Rickert Subdivision yet. Had subdivided more of it and started to put the roads in, and I got stationed at Ladd Field and Green Construction, and I got to know them working for them, and they put roads in at night, and I was selling lots, and in the meantime, when I was in the service, I bought in with partners in a pool room, restaurant, apartment complex. In fact, I built a nice apartment upstairs for myself.
Now, where was it located?
That was between Turner and was actually on the corner, what would be 3rd and Turner. Let's see, right now that would be the parking lot behind Woolworth's.
Huh. And you ran it, the pool hall? And
well, when I got out of the service, I did. Yeah, I came back and managed it then.
Did you enjoy that business?
I did. I liked it very much. Too much.
Your business is right along the line then, wasn't it?
The line was, yes. We fronted on 3rd, and then we went through to the alley behind the line, which had a fence and so on, and our back door opened on to the line. And It was kind of interesting. When I had the flowers and everything going, I had been a front door visitor of the houses, sold the girls a lot of flowers, and got to know them pretty well.
Mm-hmm. Did you? I've heard someone told on you, said you used to peek over the back there and
Well, the apartment where I lived was on the two-story part of the club, and then the pool room had a flat roof that had that, and was a kind of a patio I used, and of course it had a little built-up railing around it, and the patio was exposed to the line, so sometimes I would go out there at night and I would just peek over the top and I would see some friend of mine about ready to go in a one of the girls' houses, and I'd holler, "Don't do that."
You knew all the, a lot of them in delivering flowers, and over the years you get to know them, but there was one lady in particular who offered you quite an interesting job. Would you tell us that story?
Yes, that was kind of a, what you might call a time in your life that comes, and mine, where you make a decision of which way you're going to go. I got to know this girl, her name was Carol, and she, believe it or not, was a kind of a health addict, tanned. I don't even remember if they had I think she had some kind of a tanning device, exercise and so on, and she bought flowers once a week from me. She'd have a fresh bouquet of flowers, and so I got talking to her and asked her, of course, like everybody does, how did you happen to get into this kind of a business? And so she got out a scrapbook and showed it to me, and she had been kind of, might have been seedy, but she was in politics in San Francisco quite a bit, even to have had her picture with the mayor. Anyway, there was some kind of disruption over this thing, and she was kind of invited, or it was better for her to leave San Francisco against her wishes. So she told me she was going to try to make $40,000, and she then could go back, and she had an option on establishment down there, a bar, restaurant, nightclub type of deal. So she went ahead, and she said she was saving and she was getting close to her amount that she needed. There was a kind of a sad thing she was telling me. There was one gentleman, I met him, who come in to see her, and he was staying at the old International Hotel. And she said, "I don't know what I'm going to do with him. She says he is madly in love with me." And she says, "I just don't know what to do." And in fact, then he bought her a nice new refrigerator and everything, and she says, "I guess I'm going to have to tell him." So she did tell him, and to make a long story short, he shot himself then in the International Hotel. And that really kind of crushed her. And then she told me that she just about had her money and she was going to leave. And so she ordered a bouquet for the next day, and I took it down, and then she said she was leaving. And she asked me what I was going to do, and I said, "Well, I don't know really what I'm going to do." And she said, "Would you like to come with me?" And I said, "What on earth would I do with you?" And she said, "You could kind of be my man around the place down there." And geez, I thought, well, I says, "I don't have any money." She says, "You don't need any money." And I thought to my God, what is this? And I said, "Well, I'll let you know." And then I went home and I got to thinking, my God, what, I'm just about to go in and be a kept man or something. I don't want to go that route. So I didn't go.
You would have been the man about huh, that's interesting. We'll be back in just a moment. My guest is Bud Myers. Meet a Pioneer is about Alaskan pioneers and the history of our last frontier. And Last Frontier Realty celebrates the past and its link to our future. You're invited to visit their office at the corner of Airport and Barnett, an original Fairbanks home completely restored, including archival photographs of the interior. On the Last Frontier Realty staff are some of the most effective salespeople in Fairbanks. They employ the most up-to-date marketing plans that work for you. And don't you enjoy their friendly messages on their sign outside? Please stop by and visit Last Frontier Realty, proud of our history and proud to sponsor Meet a Pioneer.
Alaskans have always been famous for their hospitality, the same wonderful hospitality you still find at the Two Rivers Lodge, where Don and Stasha Troutman offer the best menu and interior, a comfortable, quiet atmosphere, and that famous Alaskan welcome to the people who are today's history makers. If you've been meaning to try one of the most talked-about dining experiences in the Alaskan interior, don't wait any longer. Go out tonight to the Two Rivers Lodge, 16 Mile Chena Hot Springs Road.
Well, I guess you were a pretty good boxer, so she had some ideas in mind for you.
Yeah, I guess I was going to be a bouncer, probably.
Well, you decided not to do that, obviously, and you've ended up making quite a career in real estate, and were... Tell us how that kind of came about.
Well, yes, after I got out of the service and come back, I continued in real estate. It did appeal to me, and I continued selling out Rickert Subdivision, and I also had got to know Warren Taylor, who was an attorney here. He is the father of Judge Taylor. And we were pretty good friends. And then Gridel Lee, a kind of a colorful Southern lady in real estate, we formed a triangle and went into subdividing and buying property. And one of our first purchases was what is now Lomita, and the letters stand for L-E was Lee, and M-E was Myers, and T-A was Taylor. And we originally bought the land where McKinley Subdivision is. We bought the land originally where Westgate is. We started South Cushman Subdivision as well as Lomita, so we pursued that. And in the meantime, I had sold out of one pool room and took a partner and started another one called The Upstairs. But I began to like that business, and I thought I'd better just go to real estate and get out of this business. So I took a quick course at the University of Pennsylvania in real estate to bolster up my confidence. And then I opened an office up in March of 52 and stuck to real estate and land development and so on since that time.
There's something kind of interesting. Where your office is now on Gaffney, which was that original land, I guess, that you owned.
Oh, that was one of the lots in Rickert that I sold to an old-timer then by the name of Gus Thies for, I think it was $325. And then when I wanted to put my office there, I arranged a price that would equal around $60,000 to get it back again. So you can imagine the fortune I went through selling quick and selling Fairbanks short, which I did. And
well, at that time, I guess you didn't really predict all of this. You didn't see that happening. It went from a gold time to town to not being one, and then the war to not a war. And
that's right. It was after the war, and I couldn't see any reason to further develop or at any kind of an accelerated rate Alaska. And also mining in the meantime had gone practically to pot altogether. So I didn't see too bright a future for Fairbanks, but I was far wrong because the biggest construction boom was yet to come. And it did, and so I missed that way.
Now, you married and had a couple of children in your life here.
Yes, I married my first wife as a result of taking a boxing team. I coached boxing then in the Air Force, and I took a boxing team to Edmonton and met my first wife, and my son was born in Edmonton, and my daughter was born here in Fairbanks, and my daughter now is a real estate broker in Anchorage, and my son is living in Canada. He ended up marrying a Canadian woman.
Did I hear that you ever fought Joe Louis or met him? Joe Louis?
Hey, what?
Joe Louis?
Joe Louis? Oh, in my boxing, yes, he came to Fairbanks here, and I saw him, and then also he came, and he was under a kind of old recreation for the Air Force and the services,
And he came to Anchorage then, and I got to know him a little personally and made a trip with him to Eastern Canada, to Winnipeg.
Mm-hmm.
And he was quite a man. And I met old Arthur Donovan with him and Ruby Goldstein. And it was a very interesting time.
Now, and originally, your visions of the future for Fairbanks were not quite right, but you hung in there. What are your visions of the future now?
Looking at it like a poker game, I don't want to throw my hand in, and yet I don't want to get caught too much the other way, but I think Fairbanks is stable. I don't think we're overdone. There are many things that can help Fairbanks in the long run, and so I feel more confident about the eventuality of Fairbanks being still a progressive city and ending up as a fine one.
Thank you for being on my program, Bud Myers.
And thank you for giving me the chance to talk. And thank you, people, for listening to me.
You've had a very interesting and colorful life here.
Listening to Meet a Pioneer. A taped version of this interview will become a part of the permanent oral history collection of the Alaskan Polar Regions Department at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. This program was produced by Gail Malloy.
Quite the bad girl she hinted she might be. In fact, one of the things that's following in the wake of Gloria is disappointment, at least on the part of some folks, like this New York City co-ed who was somehow expecting more.
I'm really bummed out about this. It's like a total bummer. It's like no lions and tigers and bears,
yeah.
You know.
But other people had plenty enough to suit them. Newsman Glenn Goulet, for instance, who was in the storm as she crossed Long Island.
The Hurricane Gloria is right at our doorstep, and there's a very dark, eerie, icky kind of blackness in the sky. Trees are being bent like right down to the pavement. Aluminum siding is being blown off, ripped off houses, actually. And I even a moment ago saw a spark shooting out of a power line into the trees.
Farther south, they're starting the cleanup already. Despite her mixed reviews, Gloria has done some considerable tearing up in the Carolinas, Maryland, and New Jersey. ABC's Bob Schmidt reports from Atlantic City, and his report's fairly typical.
The sun has started to come out. The tides have receded. The worst may be over for the ocean front in Atlantic City. Major buildings along the boardwalk, including a number of giant casinos, appear to have weathered the storm, but there is damage to the boardwalk itself. It is buckled in places, collapsed in others. There's lots of debris, overturned trash cans.